This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
All right, welcome to the Digital Underground podcast. Today I've got a colleague of mine from our German office, Tilman Werner, on the line, and we're going to talk about the takedown of the Kellehost / HLUX botnet, which a lot of you probably heard about earlier this week. Microsoft published some information on it, and Tilman was also very involved in Kaspersky Lab's effort to help sinkhole the botnet and did a lot of the work on reverse engineering the protocol that the bots used and analyzing the architecture of the botnet and so forth. So we're going to get some good information on how this thing works, and it's definitely not the the typical botnet that we've seen before, is it, Tilman?
No, you're right. It's very special in the way it is organized. The architecture of the botnet is fairly complex. We have a multi-tier architecture, as we call it, consisting of a set of controllers or command and control servers, but these can be replaced easily if they're, well, taken offline. If some are taken offline, you can easily bring in new ones. And then we have a second layer, which is the actual peer-to-peer botnet. It's the most important layer, or you might want to call it backbone of the botnet. Mm-hmm. And this is very dynamic. And then you have all the machines that cannot participate in the peer-to-peer layer because they don't have direct access to the internet, and that means in return that they cannot be accessed from other machines in the internet. So they cannot participate in the peer-to-peer architecture, but they can still contribute to the botnet by doing all the dirty work, like sending out spam, participating in DDoS attacks, stuff like that.
Okay. So when did you first start looking at this botnet? How long have you been analyzing it?
We started at the beginning of this year, when Shadow Server published a blog post about this miscreant, and one of the Shadow Server guys, Stephen Adair, pointed me to this piece of malware because it seemed to be very similar to WallerDeck, another botnet that has been taken down by a number of people, by a group, and I was also involved in that. So Stephen pointed me to this new one, and of course that caught my interest, and we took a closer look.
Okay, and so you started looking at it, and if you, I'll post a link to the piece that you wrote yesterday. It's excellent technical description of the botnet and the sinkholing effort. But how quickly did you discover that, you know, this botnet didn't have the normal architecture, and you know there were some special features here?
Well, we discovered that very quickly, actually, because The very early versions of the bot. So I have to explain that there are multiple versions of the bot. So there seems to be a strong an active development going on. In the early days, they pushed a new update like every 2 days or every week or so. And the earliest versions had logging capabilities. That means they would print out everything they did to the shell. So we could basically read that log when we executed the malware and try to understand what it was doing. And it was very, very, well, verbose in telling people what was going on. I think it was included for debugging purposes, and they forgot to take it out.
Okay. Okay. We've been seeing peer-to-peer botnets in various forms for several years now, but this doesn't have the same kind of design as a typical peer-to-peer botnet. A lot of the peer-to-peer parts of this one were for bots that couldn't access the internet directly. Is that right?
Yeah, so in a classical peer-to-peer botnet, you can say that all peers are equal. There is no machine with a distinct role or special role. There is no command and control server. There is no hierarchy. But in this case, there was a hierarchy, as I described previously. We had these three tiers or three different layers and also different qualities of nodes. But from a bot herder's point of view, that makes perfect sense because, For these people, it's important that the botnet is resilient against takedown attempts, right? And not what you have, for example, in file-sharing peer-to-peer networks, that the network provides anonymity within the network.
And what was the the purpose of this specific botnet was, did you observe it doing, I mean, most of them are doing spam. I know this one was involved in spam and some other things. Were they launching DDoS attacks as well? Was there any sort of crimeware involved in this one?
So we've been tracking the botnet since maybe February this year, so for 6 months, for half a year, and we've seen numerous things that were done with the botnet. Spam was definitely the main purpose, but I guess you can say that they were up to everything that you can make money with. For example, they promoted penny stocks, also via spam campaigns. Then they conducted DDoS attacks, but we are not quite sure whether that was commercially motivated or politically, because we do know for sure that some of the DDoS attacks targeted certain Russian sites that were active in political discussions. And there are some evidences that the DDoS attacks were part of a, discreditation campaign.
Yes.
So that was, maybe that was political, politically motivated. But very recently, actually right before the takedown, before the sinkholing, they started to mine Bitcoins as well. So that's something we see as a recent development in the botnet field as well, that botnets turn towards Bitcoins, they mine Bitcoins, they try to steal Bitcoins from infected computers. So I would say it was a completely commercially oriented botnet, and they were up to everything that pays.
Okay. And this botnet itself, the number of active nodes was not, it's not a huge number. I saw in your post somewhere a little more than 40,000 or something like that. And, I think Microsoft had said 41,000 at the time of the takedown. That's not huge, but, with today's compute power and the operations that you were just discussing, you don't necessarily need an enormous botnet these days.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So a botnet with only a couple of thousands of computers is really not exactly a big botnet. I agree. But for example, if you just want to send out spam mails, that is sufficient. You can still deliver like billions of spam mails per day easily with that number of computers. So it depends on the purpose.
Okay. All right. And one of the other interesting things that I saw in your post was that this botnet has a custom protocol for communications, and one of the big challenges you had was trying to reverse engineer that protocol. How was that done?
Yeah, you're right. The communication protocol that was used in the botnet was the most interesting part for us, and it was a hard nut to crack. Because usually what you have in a botnet is that people use existing libraries, often open source libraries, because they are tested, they're well known, they're easy to integrate. But in this case, they came up with a homebrew protocol, with a custom protocol that involved cryptography, that involved compression, a custom serialization format, which was used to structure the information that was passed on between the bots. And that was a bit of a pain to understand and to reverse engineer. And I give you one example. For example, they used, as I said, they used cryptography in order to protect their data or the information that gets exchanged between the bots. And they used three different layers of cryptography. They encrypted their data with triple death, which is a fairly well-known crypto algorithm. Then they encrypted it again with a Blowfish, another standard algorithm. And then they encrypted it a third time, this time with triple death again. And this is interesting because encrypting something three times with relatively comparable algorithms algorithms doesn't add more security. So we don't quite understand why they did it. And of course, it introduced complexity, but these things seemed a little odd and a little strange. But nevertheless, in the end, we understood how the protocol was implemented and what it was used for, and then we could create our own tracker and monitor what was going on in the botnet.
Okay. Do you think it was a case that the bot herders didn't necessarily understand the way that encryption works?
I'm not sure. That might be the case. Another explanation might be that they just introduced a change because they were aware that somebody was tracking their botnet or trying to track their botnet. So they introduced a change to the protocol, a slight change that was easy to implement. But for us, it was it took some time until we found out about the change and until we cracked the crypto again. Okay. So, yeah, I guess that was the motivation.
Did you have any indications from what you were seeing from the bots or the way that the botnet was behaving that the bot herders knew that you guys were tracking them?
No, I think we have never seen any indication that they're aware of that, of being tracked.
Okay. So tell me about the way that you and the other researchers went about the sinkholing effort, because it was a little different than the way that some other, you know, takedown efforts have been done in the past.
Right. So once we understood the protocol, we thought of ways to take down this botnet, because, I mean, clearly the architecture of the botnet was designed in a way to prevent the botnet from being taken down, and you might want to see that as a challenge. So we thought maybe there is a way to sort of attack this architecture. And after thinking about the protocol, we found out that we can actually announce our own peer addresses within the botnet. And that means if we do that, the bots will sooner or later start to communicate with our introduced system and see it as a regular bot. And that's what we did. And then we tried some things, or we did some tricks in order to make this introduced entry the most prevalent in the botnet. And then we had a sinkhole, because then everybody was communicating with our system and not with the real botnet anymore.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that part. I'm not sure if you want to talk about it, but how were you able to make it so that, you know, your peer became the most popular one?
I guess that's something we rather do not want to disclose, because we don't want to help the bad guys, you know, improving their botnets in the next generation.
Right. And so there's still, I noticed that, you know, a lot of the, not a lot, but the number of infected IPs connecting to the sinkhole has been declining a little bit since the takedown, which is good news. But there's still, you know, several tens of thousands that are infected. And, you know, the obvious question there is whether there's going to be some remediation effort on the, you know, to help those users, or maybe a notification effort. And I know there's a lot of discussion in the security researcher community about whether, you know, the ethics and also the legality of remotely cleaning up users' machines. And you did, you know, that wasn't done at in this case, but what are your thoughts on that in general? Do you think that that's something that should be available to researchers in these cases?
That is a tough question, but let me first comment on the first part of your question. The numbers are not on a decline, unfortunately. We checked again today, and we still count new IP addresses on our sinkhole. So right now, we don't see a real impact. I don't know why that is. Maybe the removal tools that are available right now don't reliably detect the malware. But the numbers are more or less constant right now.
Okay.
And as far as the other part is concerned, this is another very interesting aspect of this this situation here, because theoretically we would be able to push an update within the botnet ourselves, an update that would be run on all the infected machines and remove the HLUX bot. But that, of course, is not possible, because that would be tampering with other people's machines without the permission, which is, of course, illegal in most countries. So we have the interesting situation here that it's technically possible, but legally not allowed.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly illegal in most countries. But I know that there's a lot of discussion about it all the time, especially in these cases. So, I know that there have been, I can think of at least one, I can't remember exactly which instance it was, but at least users were getting a notification that their machine had been infected, and, you know, maybe given some remediation instructions or something like that. It was sometime in the last year. I wish I could remember what it was. But it's it's really good work that you guys did. It's great, and you know, it makes terrific reading. The post that you did yesterday explaining exactly the architecture of the botnet and how the takedown effort went. So I encourage everybody to go and find that and read it as well. So
just added a poll to our blog post today. So maybe a suggestion for the listeners to this podcast: if you want to go to our SecureList blog post, we have a poll set up there where we ask you about your opinion about about pushing a known update, a removal tool. So tell us what you believe is right or what you believe should be done, and we will publish or comment on the results later on.
Oh, that's a good idea. Excellent. And will you be at Virus Bulletin next week? Will I see you there?
No, I won't make it. I have another conference to attend.
Ah, that's too bad. Well, I'll see you sometime soon, I hope. And thanks a lot for your time, Tillman. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Dennis.
Right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments to Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.